We'll call the March 20th meeting of the Environment and Natural Resource Policy Committee to order. Representative Hansen, do you have a motion on the March 13th minutes?
I would move approval of the minutes. I have reviewed them and they are correct.
Thank you very much. Any discussion on the minutes? There being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The first bill before us is House File 683, recommend to pass, be referred to the Committee on Rules. Representative Fisher, to your bill.
First of all, I have two items. I have an A1 amendment and an A3 amendment that I would like to move to be able to have get the bill into the order I would like, please.
Representative Fisher moves the 683 A1. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Fisher moves to 683 A3. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. To the bill as amended. Representative Fisher moves the bill, House File 683, to be recommended, passed, referred to the Committee on Rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. The bill that we have in front of us is to help address problems that we have been a lot in the papers lately. This originally starts not only up in the White Bear Lake area by the part of the district that I'm in, but also other areas of the state, particularly in the southwest corner, where we've had problems with sustainability. And what this bill does, it does a couple of different things. Is first of all, in areas where the water is not sustainable going in, that we are going to require conservation rate structures be used in the water pricing. And then on top of that, some of the things that we have determined as we've gone through this and as I've met with the DNR and some other parties is that there's a lot of people right now that the DNR does not able to have the ability to cover in waters in areas where we have sustainability issues. And those are people who have private wells or who are small users of water. And that's what the Amendment 3 does, is it goes to the heart of that issue to give the DNR the ability to start permitting those people so that when we start entering into areas where water is not sustainable, it's being used faster in the groundwater than is currently there and is impacting other features, gives the DNR the ability to start going in and to start working with people in those situations that have the small private wells. This is something new. We have not done this before in the state. It's also one of the areas that the DNR has had some problems that they don't have the teeth to work in those issues. So what we're trying to do is give the DNR the tools that they can use to be more effective when we're managing groundwater in areas that sustainability is not occurring. I know that there's been a lot talked about in some of the other environmental committees. There's been a lot in the papers, and so I recognize a lot of the people from hearing this information before, so I'll stop at that point and entertain questions that people may have.
Questions of the author. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, first I have a question. You note that it'll be implemented unless we know that the public water supply recharge is not going down or the recharge rate is sufficient to keep it balanced. How many places do we actually know the recharge rate? What percentage of Minnesota do we know that information?
Representative Fisher.
I don't have that information right offhand. I do know that when the Met Council was doing some work on it, that they were showing that they had recharge rates and known in a lot of areas of the metropolitan area. And that's one of the things that we kind of changed with the amendments I just put on, is we chopped off the reference to recharge rates and went on to the area of sustainability. So if you take a look, I take it you're looking at Section lines 2.3 and 2.4 when you're talking about the recharge rates?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Representative Fisher, I was.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, that section we have dropped off and is replaced with the Amendment A1, which says use of all groundwater sources being utilized by public water supplier is sustainable as required under Section 103G.287, Subdivision 5. And so we did some changes through there because of it goes more to the heart of what we're trying to attack, is where we don't have sustainability occurring right now.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fisher, can you explain, because we just saw this amendment, what does this section of law in Subdivision 5 actually say? How is it different than your base bill?
Representative Fisher.
I may refer back to House research to help me a little bit on this, because it's likely that I might misstep on explaining versus how House research would be able to explain it much better than I could.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the A1 amendment changed the recharge rate standard, instead of having to know that, you would have to have a water, your all the groundwater sources that the public water supplier would use would have to be sustainable as required under existing statute, and that existing statute requires water use to be, you know, sustainable, not affect wells, not affect the ecological systems and that sort of thing, and that's an existing standard when the DNR issues a water appropriation permit for groundwater.
Representative McNamara.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Taylor. That helps a lot. I understand that now, and that's a good amendment. Representative Fisher, how will this bill affect industrial users?
Representative Fisher.
Representative McNamara, Chair Committee. Basically, in terms of industrial users, if industrial users are currently being permitted, that is already addressed by the DNR. What we're talking about here is just number one, the public water supplies for their conservation structure, and the other part would be smaller people. If we've got companies who maybe smaller companies who are not using over a million gallons a year, they would now be subject to permitting by the DNR. Right now, that nobody regulates anybody at all in terms of permitting, licensing, or the amount of water that is used by small users or private wells. And this gives the state the opportunity to assign that to the DNR so that they can start addressing those. So in that area, small users, small businesses would now be under a requirement in areas of where water is not table is not sustainable, that the DNR would start permitting them, and that would be up to the DNR, and the DNR might be able to give a little bit more light how they might address that question.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, what I'm wondering is if a business expands and they use more water, will we now charge them, so say a manufacturing line, and they have one line today, and business is good, and they want to expand here in Minnesota, and say it's on our east side where you and I live, instead of going over a short distance to Wisconsin, if they had that second line and they double the water they're using, or even if they're more efficient in the new equipment they get, it's only going to use 80% of the existing line, but they're actually increasing their water consumption by 40%, will we charge them more for the more efficient manufacturing line, the second one, than we do for the first one, or would they be exempt from this?
Representative Fisher.
I want to make sure I'm understanding. So are you saying if they get a second line in, are you saying adding an extra well for more water, or just drawing more water on the current well that they have?
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, I'd be open to both scenarios. If a manufacturing company has one line currently today and they're using water in their process, and they want to expand because business is good, and they add a second line, and it's also going to use water, but it's going to be 20% more efficient than the existing line, they're going to increase their total water consumption by 40%. Are they going to pay more, even though it's 20% more efficient? Are they going to pay more for the water on the second line, either under one of the two scenarios you talked about, either if they're using a well or if they're using city water?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara. In terms of public water, if they're using public water supply and they fall into a sustainability area, the conservation rights rate structure, even though they might be saving money in terms of their efficiencies, if they are using more water overall, they will be paying a higher rate for that water that's being used. In terms of the well water, that's going to come down to the permitting process from the DNR, and right now the DNR has a set of standards that they go through to apply when they're using their rates, they might be able to explain that more as to how they regulate in southwest Minnesota where they've run out of water and how they address that area in those situations.
Representative Urizo.
I'll pass.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, you stated that, if I got it correctly, that nobody regulates anybody at all with regards to water use. Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to have DNR come down and explain to me the current regs and how they actually do regulate people.
And
Representative Fisher.
And if I could clarify, what I was focusing on is the small users and the private wells that we have right now is what I was, when I made that comment, I was trying to reference that part right there.
Representative Fisher.
Well, then to that point, Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, how do you define a small user?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian. The way we define a small user right now is someone who uses less than 10,000 gallons a day or less than 1 million gallons per year, and water supply is serving less than 25 people for domestic purposes, and that would also cover public, private wells, individuals that have private wells on their property.
Representative Fabian.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'm just making a couple of notes here. Representative Fisher, in a small school in northwestern Minnesota, how many gallons of water do they use in a year?
At this point, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fabian, I have no idea what a small school in northern Minnesota would use.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how many gallons of water a nursing home would use?
I do not know that information right offhand, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fabian.
Maybe you could tell us. Well, so we don't have to fool around asking questions.
I
don't know the answer.
My concern, Mr. Chair, is, and with the bill, is that we're creating a situation here that's not very manageable for a lot of entities, nursing homes, schools, hospitals, that are already under fairly significant financial constraints.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I would like to mention that, first of all, this is being tailored to hit areas where we have water sustainability issues. And I would say that in areas where we're having serious water sustainability issues, that probably the bigger issue is not going to be how they're paying for the water, but the fact that they may not have enough water to conduct their businesses, as we're seeing in southwest Minnesota or in the area of Wiper Lake, where we're seeing that the lake is literally disappearing before our eyes. So it becomes an issue where we need to address it somehow, and this is a way to start cracking some of that nut, to give extra tools to the DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, obviously. But who then defines a sustainable water situation?
From my understanding, that is already outlined in the statute, and from my understanding, that is something that the DNR addresses.
Representative Fabian.
I'll go back then, Mr. Chair, to my original question. Can we have DNR come down and testify, please?
We absolutely will.
Thank you.
And Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. with some of this, I'm at least a little bit familiar with because of the past legislation that was put into place. But with suburban cities and all that, first of all, there was the conservation rate structure, and then the conservation program. And in the city of Champlin, what we did is we simply enacted a sprinkling ban for several hours during the day. And that sufficed for a significant conservation effort in terms of water usage. And this particular sprinkling ban was something from, I believe it's from 10 in the morning until, 5 at night. So we did save considerable amount of water and just water that was being wasted during the day. The conservation rate structure at one time, at least, I'm not sure if it's still in place in our city now, but we simply took a look at what the average family of four or whatever was using in water during the day. It was amazing what they were using. And we put that as the baseline, and then there was a tiered rate increase for people that used a lot of water. And while cities sell water and sometimes make money on water, our water usage did go down. So that was a good example. And as far as individual wells go, I can't speak to that, but that's a big deal out in the country for sure.
Well, Representative Ugel, Representative McNamara, and Fabian, will hear all of these questions. We'll have Mr. Hirsch from the Department of Natural Resources answer here as he speaks. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological and Water Resources Director. So I will just try, I don't know if I've got all the questions that were asked committed to memory, but I'll try to give an outline of what I think this legislation does and hopefully answer some of the questions, and then I'll try to answer whatever I didn't cover. But essentially, right now, you need a permit. If you're going to appropriate water, you need a permit from the DNR if you're appropriating more than 10,000 gallons a day. Or a million gallons a year, and that's what triggers the need for an appropriation permit. What this legislation does with regard to the permit requirement is it gives us the option to require a permit for entities that would otherwise be exempted by paragraph B in the amendment that says you know, that a section does not apply to use for a water supply by less than 25 persons for domestic purposes. So it gives us the option of requiring a permit in these situations if we need to do it because of the sustainability provisions that are already in statute. And so that, I think that's the main change with regard to who might be subject to permitting.
Representative Fabian?
I think I'm going to pass for just a minute here. Got a couple other questions at me.
Representative Mr. Hirsch, what is the estimate of number of gallons domestically that an individual uses in a home?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that.
I recall that in my days of the Water and Sewer District, it was like 70.
Yes.
70 gallons. Representative Wagenius believes that's correct. I think it's 70 gallons per day per person. I can tell you that in our community, we use significantly less than that, particularly as families expanded. When you got into families that were up more than four and five people, that number dropped off significantly. I think you can see the economies of scale on that. But anyway, I think it's around 70. So, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in the last legislative biennium, we had discussions and we passed some bills with regards to conservation rate structures. Heard testimony in committee from the Northern Pride Turkey Processing Plant in Thief River Falls that had the conservation rate structure been put in place at that time, it would have raised their expenses by as much as $40,000 per year because they're using too much water, more than a million gallons or whatever the standards were. I'm sorry, I don't remember. But you've got one agency on one side telling them they have to use water to make sure that their processing line is clean and you've got some sanitary things built in there. And then you've got another agency that's telling them they're using too much water. How do we resolve that conflict and not heap $40,000 of new expense on an industry that's already struggling?
Representative Fisher.
And that's one of the challenges that we have in areas where we are not meeting water sustainability right now. It handicaps not only businesses who are trying to come in and increase their costs, but it also goes to what's happening to our resources. Our resources that, number one, we can see on land when our lakes go down, and what happens to water availability inside. At some point, we don't have enough water go around, and we have to address that. And one of the ways that it gets addressed is by taking a look at what the pricing of water is. And it's a very difficult decision when it has an impact on the ability of a business to go on. At the same time, if we're losing the water, it can impact the availability, as I've heard in White Bear Lake, of other businesses to keep their business afloat when the water that keeps the boats afloat is no longer there.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Hirsch, does DNR have a list of cities, towns, areas of the state that are at this time deemed not sustainable?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, I don't know that we have a list, but we certainly have identified some areas of the state where we've got concerns with groundwater sustainability. A lot of those areas are in the southwest part of the state right now. Obviously, we've got concerns that have been presented in front of Representative Wagenius' committee in the metro area as well.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Hirsch, can you get me the list of the areas that are deemed not sustainable? I'm obviously particularly interested in northwestern Minnesota. To the best of your knowledge, Mr. Hirsch, are there any areas in northwestern Minnesota that have been determined at this time to be not sustainable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, I don't know. I don't recall hearing about any real problematic areas in the northwest corner of the state. As you get down into kind of the north central part of the state and you get into the sort of the sandy soil area, there are some concerns in that area. But I don't recall hearing anything about the extreme northwest corner of the state.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I think I heard you say that you wanted to move this bill today. I would ask you to hang on to this bill for a while until we could get DNR to come back with the information that I'm requesting so that I can make a more informed decision on this bill.
Representative Fisher, are there any areas, to your knowledge, in your study of this that are deficient or not being not sustainable? And I would ask you that same question about Senate District 3, 4, 5, and 6. And like every bill that's come before us, Representative Wagenius, Representative Hansen, I want to know if this has anything to do with hard rock mining. as well in those Senate districts. So could you answer that quick? Otherwise, the bill will be tabled if it has anything to do with hard rock mining. But anyway, go ahead.
As of right now, to my knowledge, it does not have anything to do with hard rock mining. In terms of the areas that I've been aware of where sustainability issues have been raised, have been more down in the southwest corner. I know the Worthington area, et cetera, they're looking at building pipelines to bring water in from the Missouri River to address problems down there. And I know it's been a hardship down there as people have been dramatically cut back on what they can use for water because the wells have literally gone dry down there. I know that up in the metropolitan area that we're looking at the White Bear Lake area, that is an issue around there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed the Minnesota League of Cities is here. I'd be interested in hearing from them and their position on this because there's a lot of metro issues with regard to this, too.
Yeah, Mr. Johnson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and thank you for the request. I think I was on the list. The League, actually, with the amendments that were added, doesn't have a particular concern. The concern that we are working on with the author and with the DNR is in the language in the original bill. As was noted earlier, there was work done over the last couple of years on the water conservation rate requirement. Folks who were here last year will remember we had water utilities from the St. Cloud area, a number of them, come in and demonstrate that they are well under 70 gallons per day per person and going down due to new plumbing codes, water-efficient appliances that are being used, and other measures they have taken locally to get large users to reduce water use. And so we changed the existing requirement for conservation rates to demonstrate that if you're getting an outcome, if you're actually getting water reduction, that's the real goal. The rate we hope will reduce use, but if you can show you already are reducing use, that should be good too. And so we made a change that shows up, members, on page 2 of the bill, lines 16 through 18, and it defines a demand reduction measure as a conservation rate structure or a uniform rate structure with a conservation program that achieves demand reduction. So it actually says you still must have a water conservation rate, or you must be able to show that you're reducing demand another way, and that would suffice. If you can show you're getting the outcome, we're not worried about the rate, we're worried about the outcome. What the current language does is actually redefines demand reduction measure to say that it must include a conservation rate structure again, and it does not leave that allowance for the second part of this any longer because it attaches the new language about the requirement of subdivision B. So we're working on that. I know the intent is not to make it so results aren't part of what we're seeking here. I think we do want to still say that getting a demand reduction is the goal. So I'm happy to keep working on that, Mr. Chair, but that is our primary concern in this right now is how do we make sure that recognition that if a utility is actually getting to where we need them to be anyway, that's what we want. That's the end result we're after.
Mr. Johnson, you're going to probably come forward in a few minutes to testify for or against the bill, so why don't you go ahead and do that while you're here.
Mr. Chair, I think I just covered my comments on the bill, so I think you just skipped that point in the process.
Representative Pavian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Johnson, just one question. I'm concerned, and I want your feedback. I'm concerned that maybe we're making a big change here, but we don't really know for sure what the impact is going to be of this. Your comments, please.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, I guess I'm not sure which big change you might be referring to, if you're referring to one of the amendments or to the base bill. The big change that I see in this bill is on the A3 amendment, and it is the new language on page 2, lines 14 through 17. And what it says is if the DNR designates a groundwater management area, that they now can have a threshold for permits that goes outside where they normally would do permit. The impact of that, you can ask DNR what a permit means, but what it primarily means is you have to have a piece of paper that shows your well was permitted by the DNR and you pay a water appropriation fee that for someone who's under that threshold is fairly low. It's about $100 a year or something close to that, I believe, but it's still a fee that they do not pay right now.
Representative Baby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be to the author. Do you have a fiscal note?
There's no fiscal note at this point in time.
Mr. Chair, then again, I would renew my request of you to hang on to this bill until we get some more information.
Could you, since we have the Environment Finance Chair in the room, could you indicate to her where you believe the fiscal note might be in place, where a fiscal note on this bill might be needed?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would say that the part that we just talked about, that's requiring permitting from DNR, anytime we require a permit for anything, it's going to take up time from the agency to do that, and we're using FTEs to accomplish these things.
Mr. Hirsch, in the case of getting a permit at the Department for a Water Appropriation Permit, as I recall, not only is there a monthly fee on every single person that's hooked onto the thing, it was like about $5.75 on an ongoing per month basis that goes from the utility to the DNR. It was a surcharge that was put on some number of years ago, but there's also a permit fee at the outset and ongoing cost for the water appropriation and the renewal and all that stuff. So I threw out a whole bunch of stuff, and can you tell me what's right and what's wrong and where we're going?
Mr. Chairman, that's generally correct. There's a permit application fee, and then depending on the amount of water you use, there's a rate that's charged per million gallons. Now, again, the permits are issued to basically larger water users. You have to exceed that 10,000 gallon per day or million gallon per year threshold in order to need a permit from the DNR. And so individual domestic well users do not generally need a permit from us. People that are covered under a municipal water supply, it's the municipal water supplier that gets the permit and pays the fee, the water, the application fee and the water use fees for the permit, and then of course they obviously pass some of those expenses down to the actual individual users of the water. But that's generally how it works. I'm not sure if I covered everything you asked there.
Well, you got pretty close, and then my next question is would be of Representative Wagenius. In your assessment, in detailed assessment of the budget over your tenure here, have those fees for issuance of a permit? And they're going to stream more. I think you would have issue with the idea that we're paying enough for the water, but the issuance of the permit, would you think, in your opinion, a fiscal note would be required on this bill?
Well, what I understand is the general fund money for this section of DNR has gone down like this. The number of permits has gone up like this. But the thing we're not taking into consideration right now is how much time DNR staff is having to spend on in areas where there are well conflicts. And that is where the huge amount of expenditure of time. So we've permitted too many wells. And Aunt Martha's well is not got enough water in it because Uncle Jim has used more than we thought he was going to use, and DNR is trying to resolve those conflicts. That's where I see so much staff's time being spent right now, and that this may be cheaper. That's my first, because we have well conflict areas in Kandy, Ojai County, in the Bonanza Valley. We have it in the Strait River, so I've never heard of anything north of there for conflicts. Marshall is having a devil of a time getting water, and that's a agriculture production area. So DNR is spending a lot of time in Marshall, helping them out. It's hard to weigh all of what you've just asked me. We've had scads of testimony in Environment Finance Committee about areas of the state that are under stress for water. And you have to worry about your businesses who don't have enough water. We heard testimony about a business that went to South Dakota, not because of taxes, because there wasn't enough water in Worthington. So we really do want to manage it so everybody has their fair share. And I think that what Representative Fisher is after is making sure everybody gets their fair share of water in an aquifer that's going like this?
I'm unclear after all of that.
Yeah.
Whether a fiscal note is actually required on the bill. Representative Fisher.
We would do one if it's...
Right. What I was going to, if I could, Mr. Chair, committee, mention is that obviously there's going to be things that are going to impact this in terms of fiscal. If you start having extra permits, there's going to be extra revenue along that side. There's going to be time to take it. But before the request for the fiscal note went in, we wanted to make sure that we got past the policy committee. There was no sense in trying to spend time getting a fiscal note added if we didn't know if we were going to make it past policy committee, which is why this is being referred to the finance committee after this point. And that's when we would make the request for the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm just going to ask the question. This is a policy committee. Why are we concerned with that? Isn't the issue whether this is good policy or not? And the issue of fiscal note would follow in the next committee. And if the chair of the committee feels that, and the members there feel that it's not workable, then that's the end of the bill, isn't it?
Well, Representative Benson, that's actually not quite true.
No.
The bill is going to be referred to rules, and the rules could send it straight to the floor. That will not be my recommendation. I mean, obviously, my recommendation is to send it back because it was not going to meet deadlines, that we're going to send it back through rules and back to Representative Lagenius's committee so that these questions can actually get answered.
Yeah.
So I was trying to flesh out here in a very quick way if that was going to be what I actually was going to recommend when I do talk to the people up in the hindquarters.
Well, Mr. Chair, we hope we do it your way so we don't have another hour and a half or two-hour debate on the floor of the House as to where some bill ought to be going.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Benson's point, my first question or first reason for keeping the bill here was because of my question about sustainability and the definition of that and those things that are going on around the state. And until those questions are answered, I'm not comfortable with the bill, obviously. So, can I? And then one of the other things for Mr. Hirsch, if I may, Mr. Chair, can we get some sort of a definition of what sustainability is?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, I think it's really very simple. Sustainability means that your output does not exceed your input, so that the aquifer is at least staying level through time. Now, you might see fluctuations in a given year where it goes down and it goes up. But if you've got, a flat trend in the aquifer level, then it's sustainable. If you've got a declining trend, then it isn't sustainable. So I think it's a pretty simple concept.
And Representative Fabian, Ms. Taylor's looking up the definition right now. So if we have any other questions, and then we'll come back to that. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a number of them. I'll ask them pretty quick.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, does this bill affect a person with a private well?
A
resident, excuse me for interrupting, but a private home, it's private well, if they have a private well.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, it would, and this would be the first time that we're doing it, and I thought I made it clear in my opening statements that this is an area that we have not done this before. But it's something that we're recommending, but it would only affect those that are in areas where we're having water sustainability issues. And if I could put out the example up in the White Bear Lake area, you've got a lot of communities up there who are on public well systems who are trying to do something, but you have many, many hundreds and into the thousands of private wells that are drilled in the area because they're not on public water systems, who are not doing anything or who are not part of the permitting process and are pumping as much as they want. And this gives the DNR the tools in those areas to be able to start addressing those issues, because there gets to be turmoil between the communities when some of them feel they're doing something and they're seeing their neighbors in the surrounding communities putting in new wells and watering like crazy, or putting in big pools and filling the pools up, and they're seeing their lake levels go down. And that's part of the reason some of this is coming forward, because of the tension within communities and giving the option for the government to try to do something to help reduce that tension.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and Representative Fisher, I'm assuming this would also apply to southwestern Minnesota, where there's some water sustainability issues. So we now are allowing the DNR to say you can't build a house in southwestern Minnesota, you can't build a house in White Bear Lake. But Representative Fisher, are you aware that in the city of White Bear Lake, they recently, I don't know how many years ago now, they started to sell their city water to the city of Montemedi and to White Bear Township. And why would the city of White Bear have done that? Why would, and I guess this would be a question for Director Hirsch, did that require a DNR permit? Did DNR permit White Bear Lake to do that? And here we are, now we're going to pass a bill that says you can't build a house potentially in White Bear Lake. But how long ago did we allow White Bear Lake to start selling water when they should have just made them buy it from St. Paul, who's got 25 million gallons?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the permit that we have with White Bear Lake is for the amount of water that they use. And so what they actually do with it after that, we don't necessarily review. I mean, we would know about it, but we don't necessarily permit that.
Ms. Ward, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I think we're trying to do here is recognize and acknowledge that we have a water problem and we need to do something to get management on it. We're trying to do some things differently. We're looking at a lot of information. You gentlemen were asking these questions about other parts of the state. I keep thinking of the maps that we've seen in the Finance Committee and the areas where we are doing some water preservation techniques in the metro area, and we are still facing serious, serious water shortages. So if Worthington is going to Iowa to buy their water, I think the metro area is going to be looking on your neighborhood eventually, unless we can put some kind of controls on this. So I would be in favor of approving this.
Okay. Next, Representative Fabian, Representative
McNamara. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fisher. I actually like conservation water rates for private homes. I like that idea. We passed legislation that really encourages communities to do that in the last 2 years, or to find other ways to conserve. But the pass law, I mean, we just heard White Bear Lake sells water to White Bear Township in Montemedi instead of having them buy it from St. Paul because it would be more expensive. Well, just say no. How about being a little bit smart here? Now we got the scenario I laid out. You got a business that's going to double the size of their business, create some jobs, hire some more people. Their new equipment is 20% more efficient, but we're going to charge them more for the water on that. Why don't you concentrate on the issue before us and concentrate on conservation water rates for where they make sense and not do some of this stuff that doesn't make any sense? It's just frustrating to see, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Fisher, in talking about private wells, in the case you referenced White Bear Lake, so a individual has a private well, and the sustainability is already an issue there, so I assume that would be a sustainability area as defined. How would the conservation rates apply to a private well that isn't metered by either the DNR because it's under the limits, or it isn't metered by the city or a municipality or a township or something? So how could you force a conservation rate onto a private well that you don't have any metering on?
That's a great question, because right now we aren't talking about conservation rates on a well in that type of situation. What we're just saying at this point in time, they need to be going to the DNR for permitting, and the DNR at that point in time would determine what the appropriate permitting pricing is. And then from there, they have other tools if it becomes a serious issue, if they need to be doing metering or not. And I think that's one of the issues that the DNR is going to have to work on and take a look at. And going to the question about conservation rate, I think the first step is that the fact is that now they're going to have to get a permit and start doing something in a water sustainability area. In some ways, they're starting to get a little bit toward that pricing. Right now, they pay nothing, and they can pump as much as they want. Now we've got the opportunity for the DNR to come in with a permitting process and say, if we know you're pumping X amount, and how they determine that, they may have other ways to do it besides through requiring a meter to be put in. I'm going to leave that to the experts to figure that out, because that's beyond my pay grade at this point in time.
Questions. Representative Hugo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question of I guess the DNR. Right now, if you have existing wells in White Bear Lakes Township or whatever, those wells, of course, are not going to be permitted. You really don't have too many ways to go about finding where those are or anything. This would just be for new wells?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the way I read the bill, what it would do is if we've got, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if we've got a designated groundwater management area, what this bill does is it gives us the discretion to require permits from people that are using less water than currently trip the thresholds for a permit. It doesn't say that we will do it. It says that we may do it. And the way, if we got this authority, you know, what we would look at is in a particular groundwater management area, if we've got a sustainability issue where the use is causing the aquifer to decline and some of these smaller water users, because there were enough of them, they were adding enough to the problem that we could get all the large water users together and agree on allocation rates, and we'd still have a sustainability issue because we couldn't regulate the smaller users, the domestic users. That's where we would apply this. We would only apply it if we needed to address the sustainability issue. That's how I read what the legislation is trying to do, and I think that's how we would use it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. One comment, at least. I guess really it's a sign of the times, particularly a sign of the times here in the metro area, and a sign of the times in certain areas outstate. 20 years ago, I never would have believed we'd be sitting here discussing something like this. Up in Representative Fabian's area, I don't think it'll probably ever be a problem, or in yours either. But it's something that I think we do have to address in the areas that we're hurting right now, and it's difficult because I know Representative Fabian always thinking about, you know, the individuals, and it does infringe a little bit. We've always considered water a free good in this state, but unfortunately, I think the future is going to be much different. Thank you.
I'd like to say something about the water, at least to the residential water up in my particular area. Almost all of my neighbors' wells are 400 feet, and not one of them got any water in them until you frack them. And so, you frack them, and then you got water, because, I mean, those little veins... I learned from Mr. Griffin what those are called, down in the canal there, the cracks. Anyway, those are hard to hit when you got a 6-inch hole or an 8-inch hole going down there. But they work pretty good when you frack that with water pressure. Works pretty well then, and then we have abundant water. But I will say this much: the Culligan man is in love with this because it's they don't call it Iron Country for nothing. So anyway, Representative Fisher. For those testifying for or against. Here we go. Mr. Quill, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tony Quill, Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I apologize to Representative Fisher right out of the gate. I haven't talked to him about this, but I've been listening very intently to the conversation. We had a brief conversation with Representative Vogelius's committee earlier this year, at least from my perspective, on the things that are going to be happening in the environmental arena this year. And I agree with Representative Vogelius that this is, I think, the most important conversation we're going to have in this state regarding and how we, appropriate water. We're talking about individual wells, but we also, I'd like to, remind you also, Mr. Johnson told you about, municipal wells and public water supplies, but when you get into rural Minnesota, into some areas up in Carlstead, or you go into southeastern Minnesota, not all of those businesses in there are on public water systems or municipal water systems. I'm not sure that if it's a snowmaking, if you're at Welsh Village down in southern Minnesota, whether or not they've got their own well or not. If you're looking at agricultural processing, livestock watering, golf courses, landscaping, nursery, orchards, major crop irrigation. So I don't know if all of those are on public water supplies or not, but in this debate, please keep those businesses in mind as we go through. Not all of us are fortunate enough to be where Representative Dill is, or some of us from central Minnesota where we've got a lot of water. But I just wanted to point that out, that to please keep that in mind for especially, you know, it's easier for us, as Representative Uglin pointed out, in the metropolitan area to kind of put our heads around it, but also keep in mind in rural Minnesota, specifically in southeast and southwestern Minnesota, that there are businesses down there, too, that aren't on public water supplies, that are on individual wells. So I just wanted to point that out to the committee, Mr.
Questions of Mr. Quiller? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative or Mr. Quillis. So, if we have to choose, I mean, what is more important? Is it drinking? I'm not talking about showers or baths or watering the lawn. I'm talking about drinking water for people, or water for industry. Where do we choose?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Quillis, could you walk on water?
Mr. Chairman, what's great about this is I don't have an election certificate and I don't have to make this decision for you, but I think there, Representative Wagenius and I have had this conversation also. I mean, we are blessed in this state with 10,000 lakes. Tourism and recreational opportunities, and we've talked about trout streams before, that are unbelievable. Walleye fishing. I mean, the tourism recreation that are ongoing, you know, as individuals we use a lot of it, some of us less than others, if we've got conservation rates and go through and use other things that are available to us. And I think there can be a mix there, but I think we have to keep both, if you will. I mean, I don't think that you can just say, okay, we're just going to do drinking water, and we're not going to do anything to, you know, having concerned of groundwater or surface water, how we use it in this state, and whether it's agriculture, whether it's mining. Mr. Chairman, I mean, I think you have to factor all of that in there, and I don't think it's an either-or question.
Representative Hansen, and we're 50 minutes on the bill right now, so we're going to take a few more questions and then make our decision.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Quillis, so I'm sitting here looking at a bottle of water, and I'm thinking about when I grew up on a farm, and I would go out and turn on the hose, and we'd water the chickens, and we'd fill the tank to do the spraying, or we would be watering the hogs. We just turned it on, and we turned on the hose. Never would have thought that we'd be paying for water for drinking. Never thought that we would be. It was free. All I had to do is walk and turn on the faucet. But we've learned that nothing's free, and that there is a cost. And there's a cost involved with, and we have to make choices in those costs. So implementing conservation practices, whether it's at a nursing home or whether it's at a school or whether it's at a business, there's a cost involved. We pay for water now. We pay for our drinking water. It's kind of a fascinating debate that we're having here because the world has changed. And we can wish it hadn't. I'd like to go back to where I just turned on the faucet and that was the way it was. But there's a cost. I've had to replace piping on wells on my farm. It's not cheap. Keep looking for more water. Not cheap. So prevention is cheaper than cleanup. Prevention is cheaper than having to look for more water. And we've got areas where there isn't water's going to be a problem. Water is a problem. And so we've got to put some preventive practices in so that we have water so we can have industry, so we can have agriculture, and I think the primary source is whether we're having water for people.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I have to say that I've been here since when Peter and I first walked in the door, and he's been really working on this and keeping me in the loop on this, and I have to say that I'm really appreciative of the work he's done, and I realize that this isn't going to be where we solve this problem, but I do think that we need to recognize that, especially when you look at what White Bear Lake's been going through, that that's the canary in some respects, and we need to begin to take proactive steps on that. And so I think there's a sense of urgency behind this, and I hope that we can get this moving on as fast as possible to begin to address some of those and take on other big issues in that area. Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to echo quickly. House Bill 683 is a conversation that's continuing. We need to continue to have it. Water for, as Representative Hansen said, for domestic supply as well as industry. We've got to start conserving in a more serious manner. And I do want to remind the chair.
and your remarks about walking on water. We're quite blessed in Minnesota, quite blessed. Many of us have the opportunity to walk on water every winter.
Right. That is correct. Yeah, Representative Urusso, it takes about 5 inches for me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I think, you know, one of the things we're struggling with is that we have never been forced to pay attention to this in the past, and we've treated all water as if it's the same. And we need to start distinguishing between groundwater and surface water and different uses of water. And we haven't taken any of the steps that they have in other geographic areas to deal with this situation. In other places, they distinguish between drinking water and gray water. And there are ways you can use the same water, you know, two or three times to accomplish different purposes. We haven't, you know, scratched the surface on that at all. So we have a lot of opportunities, things that we can do that can help fix this situation. And some of them are going to cost money. And unfortunately, one of the ways we structure society is sometimes we have to make people do stuff by making it cost a little more to do it the wrong way. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius. Okay. So, Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Taylor might have just some technical corrections on the A1 amendment.
All right, and then also, Ms. Taylor, it reminds me that you were looking up the definition of sustainability. If you were able to locate that, could you enlighten us on that, make the changes to the A1, and then we'll adopt those?
Mr. Chair, members, just as the Chair mentioned, I did look up what currently is the standard for sustainability under the statute that's referenced in the A1, and right now it states that a groundwater appropriation permit can only be issued if the commissioner determines that the groundwater use is sustainable to supply the needs of future generations and the proposed use will not harm ecosystems, degrade water, or reduce water levels beyond the reach of public water supply and private domestic wells constructed according to Minnesota rules.
Thank you. And then the technical amendment to the A1.
On the A1, if on line 1.2, it should read page 2, line 3, instead of page 2, line 2.
Chair moves the amendment, oral amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Ms. Taylor, don't we need to delete line 1.15?
Yes, we do.
Okay, so will you repeat the amendment then so we get it fully on
sure.
the tape correctly?
Thank you. The amendment would read on line 1.2, page 2, line 2 should read page 2, line 3, and then delete line 1.5 of the amendment.
Chair moves the oral amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, so we've spent 54 minutes on the bill. We're after the bill is not going to make deadlines. It has to go to rule. The chair is going to move to lay the bill over. We're going to hear it immediately after we return from Easter break. And by that time, we need to have some of these questions answered, a little more refinement. The fact is that I'm not going to let a bill out of here that we should be probably spending many, many hours on to understand the impacts of it. I am all for this. I think it's a great thing. I mean, in our community, in our little town of 261 people, we went door to door preaching this because of what it costs to treat that water and to provide that water. And we have an abundance of water in that community of Orr, just water flowing wells. But as you do, Representative Fabian, in your area. But, I mean, this is like serious business. I mean, this has impact hundreds and hundreds, billions of dollars worth of industry, let alone the drinking water. I mean, unless you're going to live off the land subsistently, how do you live unless you have a job? So if you don't have water to have a job, you don't need drinking water because you're going to move somewhere else. So, I mean, we got a real problem here. And so, but we're not going to solve it today in this time period allotted, and I think there are too many questions. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm disappointed that we're not going to resolve this today. But I would like, just for the record, for us to separate the amount of money that DNR charges for water, which Representative Uglum is right, we give our water away, it is free. The charge for a gallon of water, and I think I'll bring one to my committee tomorrow just so people get it in their head, the charge for a gallon of water is on average from DNR 0.001 cent a gallon. So when you're talking about these conservation charges, it is what the municipality is charging, and some of those municipalities may be using the water to make money. You are
almost everyone does.
I mean, I think hearing what he said, I was just thinking, oh, why hasn't somebody said that before? So what we are talking about is a municipality with local units of government who are wanting to keep those people living in that community, and maybe you don't have enough water. And he doesn't have enough water in his community. And it is a problem we've got to solve. I have enough water in my community because we drink many river water. But he doesn't, and there are communities in the state that don't, and those communities may not be able to support industry at all because they don't have water anymore. And so we're in a fast track for saying to some areas of the state, don't even think about bringing a business here because we don't have water anymore.
I share every single thing that you said, Representative Bogenius. I share with you. I mean, I'm a business person, as you know, and I was a city administrator, and I'll tell you how we made money. Because the water was so darn cheap from the DNR, it was really simple to mark it up 1,000%.
Exactly.
And it was still cost-free.
Yep.
And we made 1,000% return on investment minus your infrastructure costs, which get paid for by WIF and PFA and every other imaginable thing and a few little charges here and there. So, I mean, it was a way to keep your levy down. I mean, it's just the way it is, Representative Bogenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. People have kept their levy down, and that's why Worthington, not knowing how much water was underneath, ran out of water. Just ran out. That is how Marshall, these are both big food processing areas in our state. Food processing, not growing crop, but big processors running out of water. You can't operate a state without water. Now, there are more tools in the toolbox that we haven't talked about, like reuse. Minnesota just thinks we have so much water, we haven't even thought about reuse. It's something we've got to move fast on.
The bill is laid over. We will hear it again. And we will get some of these answers, and we will do it, and then we will send it to rules, and then it will go, at my recommendation, then to Representative Laginius's committee. I know that wasn't the outcome we were headed for when we got here, but I don't feel as a chair that we should move the bill right at this second. All right, the next bill is House File 757, first engrossment recommended to pass and re-referred to rules, the same as the previous bill, Representative Wills. Give you a little background, members. I serve on the Ag Committee. I authored the bill with Representative Wills, and when we got to the Ag Committee, Representative Laginius was there at the very least. I'm thinking about who else serves on Ag in here. Representative Hansen, and so many questions came out on this bill that we could not help but to send it to Environment Policy because it had to do with servitude. Representative Wills, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm grateful to be before you today to present House File 757.
Well, Representative, you can tell the truth. You would have just preferred to go right straight where you wanted to go. We're glad you're here, but go ahead. Nice. You can tell the truth.
Well, it's for a technical purpose because I was concerned about getting to the deadline, but I understand because it's being heard past the first deadline, and we're still unsure whether it's going to be included on the Senate side in their environment policy omnibus bill. I was trying to expedite and find a way to do that, but I'm happy to have it before you today. So I would ask that somebody be able to move it so I can.
So moved.
Representative Isaacson moves House File 757. Recommend to go to rules.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. I appreciate that. So this bill would allow the Minnesota Zoo to import wild animals for its collections by gaining permission from the DNR and the Board of Animal Health. There are certain animals, in the cervidae in particular, that cannot be imported unless they meet very strict regulations. Wild cervidae do not meet these regulations. So the Board of Animal Health, the DNR, and the Minnesota Zoo have been working together for, I think, 6 years to find a solution that would both protect the native herds and allow the Minnesota Zoo to import these animals to replenish their collections. And so I have the Minnesota Zoo Director and CEO, Lee Emke, and also Dr. Paul Anderson from the Board of Animal Health to explain the bill.
Welcome, gentlemen. You were greatly missed at the last committee. So introduce yourself for the committee and give your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm Lee Emke. I'm the director of the Minnesota Zoo. And I am sorry I missed the last hearing, but happy to take any questions. I think most straightforwardly, we do exhibit cervidae at the zoo, moose in particular. And on occasion, we need to replenish our collection. And our ability to do so has been limited by concerns about the chronic wasting disease and the current regulations that we're looking at today. We need to be able to certify, either to be able to certify that the animal is coming from a herd that has been surveilled for at least 5 years and is free of chronic wasting disease. And we've done that in the past with other institutions, other zoos that have had moose that have, and other deer that have been in a surveilled situation. But the situation of obtaining a wild animal, a wild moose in particular, obviously that is an animal that has not been through a surveilled program, and so the current regulations don't allow us to bring those into our collection. This exemption would allow us to do that with the permission of the DNR and the Board of Animal Health.
And Mr. Lampy, you mentioned the moose, but when Representative Will gave, she talked about possibly others, as I heard her say, other cervidae as well. Is this only on the moose? Because I think in the last hearing, that's what we talked about almost exclusively, or is it, could this be others as well?
Mr. Chair, this could apply to other cervidae as well, and there, in fact, are other deer species that have been in our collection in the past and that we might want to add in the future, including there's a very endangered small deer from South America called a kudu, which we believe the current restriction would apply to, even though they come from a region where there is no chronic wasting disease known. And this exemption would allow us, again, to import those animals from either other zoos or from the wild to develop a captive breeding program.
Okay, thank you for that. And then the other big burning question was about genetics, the fact that it was mentioned by Representative Wills that maybe an Alaskan moose arrived here, and that the current moose is from the eastern herd of the Ontario moose, or the northeastern herd, actually, which is the same herd of moose of Minnesota, and that A plus B might equal C, and that might start changing the genetics of the moose strain. And that's another question that we got deep into and we didn't understand, and at that time, we couldn't get enough information.
Mr. Chair, I'm not a geneticist nor even a zoologist, so I'll rely on the information that was given by our experts. There is one species of moose, Alces, that ranges throughout North America and, in fact, is found over the entire northern Asia and northern Europe area. There are regional variations, which one, in some experts consider them subspecies, others consider them geographic races. But they are primarily considered to be a single species. Any breeding that would happen at our zoo would not be for a reintroduction purpose into the wild. So although it's possible, they're certainly capable of breeding, and I don't think there would be any concern about inbreeding. In fact, it would be more of an outbreeding situation.
Okay, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had in committee and that hasn't been addressed yet is we are, this is for Apple Valley, we are getting warmer, we are in zone 5 for growing things now, and I said in the Ag Committee, I have a peach tree I put in my yard last year, and in the newspaper today, there was somebody talking about the peach tree they had in South Minneapolis. So it's warm. It gets hot in the summer. Alaska, we're bringing moose down from Alaska, multiple zones north. Yet, in committee, we have heard so much testimony about the stress on moose that have to do with the heat.
And so I don't, I question biology of bringing a moose down from a cold area into an area that's hot in the summertime. It doesn't, given the testimony we have repeatedly had in Environment Committee about our moose population in northern Minnesota shrinking rapidly, and it's been attributed to heat.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, we realize that Apple Valley would not be the normal range for even the Minnesota moose. It is further south than the natural range. And like many of the species at the zoo, most of the species that we exhibit at the zoo are not actually in their natural range when they're at our facility. And we design our facilities to accommodate that. So in particular, our moose are provided with shade, sprinklers, a deep pool, ways to become comfortable in the summer heat, that, and we've had great success with breeding over the years, and longevity of our moose is quite noteworthy as well. So I think we've been able to accommodate the differences between the natural environment of the animals in our collection and what we're providing them at the zoo.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is a question more for the Board of Animal Health, but taking a wild animal and bringing it into the zoo environment, is there a quarantine period? And do you do, let's say for the cervids, is there like a brucellosis test? Or, I mean, do you have the vaccinations that are involved when you're moving it into an urbanized environment like this? Maybe just a little bit of help on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, yes, we have extensive quarantine protocols in place and facilities. So our animals that come in from outside of the zoo are held for as long as 60, actually sometimes 90 days, and are treated, tested and treated for anything that they might be bringing into the collection.
Do you have further comment?
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Anderson. I'm with the Board of Animal Health. To answer just a little bit more on that question, diseases like brucellosis, we can test these animals for very readily. We have good tests. For chronic wasting disease, there's no live animal test that's reliable. And so really what we're looking at is the origin of these animals. And with our counterparts at the DNR and with our folks, you know, we would try to help the zoo evaluate the risk of bringing an animal, for example, out of Alaska. There's never been chronic waste disease known to exist in the wild. Nor in Peru or Chile or these countries. So we certainly would not recommend bringing an animal from an area where these diseases exist. But we'd be looking at that sort of thing. Tuberculosis, we can test these animals for. Lots of things we can do, but chronic wasting disease, we cannot.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess one of the things that comes with age is memory, and I remember the beluga issues, and I remember the dolphin issues, and so what happens if we've got a problem here like we've had with some of the other species? I think the belugas, I remember watching or seeing in the paper when we went and captured those out of Hudson Bay back in the 70s, if I remember correctly. So taking the wild animals into the zoo environment, and if something goes south on them, what then? Do we move them to another zoo? Do we euthanize them? Or, I mean, we've had a couple of examples here, which I know on those previous issues, the public gets very engaged on them. So, from the zoo, I'd like to kind of hear what if.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I guess I'll start with the obvious fact that every animal dies, and that is a reality of maintaining a living collection like the zoo. We have highly trained veterinary staff. We work with our associates at the Board of Animal Health and DNR, as well as animal health advisors from around the globe, to make sure we're providing the best care for the animals that we can at our facilities. And obviously, I guess the biggest concern in terms of disease risk is could that disease, if it manifested itself at the zoo spread outside the zoo. And that's one of the requirements of our USDA license, is that we have a very secure site that doesn't allow animals out or in to our collection. So should an animal suffer a health issue within the zoo, it's contained. It's something that we will try to address with the best care and knowledge that we have. But I think in many ways, you know, I think that assurances that and the working relationship that we've had with the Board of Animal Health and the DNR is proof of the fact that we have pretty good protocols in place to deal with that.
Okay, Representative Guinness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me just clarify that from your earlier testimony, it is your intention to provide the same temperature and same kind of habitat that a moose would enjoy in Alaska at the zoo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, essentially, yes. We would look to replicate to the degree possible the natural conditions or the level of comfort that the animal would experience in the wild.
If I could follow up. Do you have the money at this point for that?
Ms. Lepke?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, our current facilities actually provide that. We have a moose exhibit and moose holding areas with all of the features that I mentioned, the pool, the sprinkler, the substrates, and the shade are all actually in place now. And this, again, this exemption that we're seeking is not for a particular need immediately. It's for potential incidents further down the road where we may need to have an opportunity or may need to bring in animals for our collection.
Thank you. Well, the earlier testimony was that you were looking at moose pups from Alaska, and since these would be the first from Alaska, and you're relying on a facility that was built for Minnesota moose, I am still troubled by where we're going to put this moose.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, there is no immediate plan in place to bring in animals from anywhere. We have five moose currently at the facility. We're just looking at the potential opportunity down the road. Should there be an orphan moose found in Alaska that needs to be placed in a new home, and we were at that point in a position where we wanted or needed to bring in new animals to the collection, this would allow us to do that. And again, I would state that many animals are quite adaptable to a range of conditions, and certainly Alaska has a wide range of both heat and cold extremes, which we would mitigate. The extremes that occur here in Minnesota are mitigated by the environment that we provide for the animals.
Question. I think it's interesting that you would go to Alaska to get a moose, maybe what you want to do. Why wouldn't you go to Quetico Park or the Wapatimi Park or across the border from, 50 miles from Grand Portage and get a moose from the Canadians and bring it down here so that you have a moose like what we have moose here rather than a 70-inch bull that's up on the north slope on the Kruger-Arc River?
Mr. Chair, again, this is all speculative. We are not at this point seeking, or it's not a bring them back alive situation where we're going to look to bring animals into our collection. This is just providing the opportunity in the future if the need arises, and if there's an animal that needs to be placed in a new home, whether it's from Alaska, Quebec, Ontario, or right here in Minnesota.
So what I think has happened is that when the bill was first introduced in ag, and you hear these questions coming from mainly the three ag people on the committee, there was a picture of a moose up on the screen, a rather poor one. I could have provided a much better picture of a moose. It's still alive, by the way. And but anyway, now I have a better understanding of this. So any further questions? Anybody to testify for or against? Also, is the large animal coordinator in here from the DNR? Nope. Okay. Representative Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that I think we haven't covered in this potential transaction is what would the boundaries be for the Board of Animal Health? So you found an orphan, you know, someone found an orphan moose in Alaska and offered it to, what's the process? How would you say no? If you thought it what would, under what conditions would you think it would not be appropriate or safe? Because you would be the gatekeeper.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, chronic wasting disease is probably the thing that we're most concerned with. And like I said, some of these other diseases we can use tests, find out if the animals are free. With chronic wasting disease, it's much tougher. But if we look at the geography and if we consult with the wildlife experts as well, I think that we can come to a decision whether an animal is coming from a very low-risk area where the risk would be as small as we can get it. And certainly we wouldn't want to bring animals in from Colorado or Wyoming. But if we're bringing them from Alaska or some parts of Canada, I think that with the disease and with what we know about it, that we could probably pretty safely do that.
Anyone to testify for or against? All right, there being none, Representative Isaacson renews his motion that House File 757 be recommended to pass, referred to Committee on Rules. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevailed. Okay, the next item will be a Hansen bill. Now, I'm telling you, we're going to run out of time on this bill, and if we get into the weeds on this one, literally, we'll have to take the same approach that we did on the first bill we took up. Representative Hansen moves that the House File 1442 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. And Representative Hansen, you did not have any amendments?
No, there is an A2.
Oh, there is an amendment?
So I would move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like.
Representative Hansen moves the 442 A2 in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And 1442 is a bill relating to aquatic invasive species and relating to having a decal. And I have Mr. Erdman with me, who is going to walk through the bill.
Mr. Erdman, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Henry Erdman, here today on behalf of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates, formerly known as MSRPO, which you commonly know as the cabin owners. Mr. Chairman, this bill has absolutely nothing to do with hard rock mining. And
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I want to thank the chairman and the committee for their time today and Representative Hansen for sponsoring this legislation. This is really a citizen-based initiative. It's coming from groundswell of support from our lake associations and lake influence property owners. And what this does is it is based upon a successful and stable enacted in the state of Wyoming policy. And this is what they do in the state of Wyoming. The policy provisions of the bill are twofold. It provides an opportunity to educate the public through an annual point of contact. It ensures that out-of-state watercraft contribute to the preservation and protection of Minnesota waters and to learn about AIS laws, regulations, and prevention methods in Minnesota. Having an annual program will afford boaters the opportunity to become familiar with state laws and regulations on AIS, and in doing this, we are able to get information and educational materials to those who can have a significant impact on stopping the spread of AIS, and that would be the boating community. Additionally, this would provide a stable and funding mechanism for AIS prevention and containment activities. We would also propose that the additional funds raised under this proposal be allocated exclusively for AIS prevention activities. We would also support additional grant allocations to local units of government and their partnerships with the DNR and dedicated decontamination locations. In summary, this proposal addresses the following key components: a stable funding mechanism for prevention and containment efforts, and an opportunity to familiarize the boating public with the rules and regulations concerning AIS in the state of Minnesota. We stand ready to work with the department, as we've had many conversations with them and interested parties and legislators, as this bill moves hopefully forward, to continue the conversation and try to craft a good bill. Thank you.
Questions for the author or for Mr. Erdman? I have a question. I got several emails on the bill today, and one of the ongoing emails is that the boat registrations are already high enough and we're taxing the people out of existence that own boats.
That's nonsense.
And that the people of Minnesota, meaning all of the people, should be paying for this problem, as the boat owners are already paying for it through their registration. I wonder if the committee members have, it's kind of an open question I have here. I sense that, I asked Representative Wagenius, aren't we taking money from the Clean Water Fund and the different funds that came from the 3.75% additional sales tax and dedicating it towards AIS and from the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council and dedicating that towards the spread of big-headed carp and those kinds of things? And how does that all play in your mind, into the public paying? Because everyone is paying sales tax, whether you visit here or whether you live here, when you purchase things. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The most money I see comes out of the lottery money from the trust fund. I think there's more than $8 million going for the aquatic species research at the U in the trust fund bill. It'll be up in Ways and Means in about half an hour. There is also not aquatic invasive, but there's some terrestrial invasive appropriations in that bill. Very little clean water money. And I'm just trying to think. Some of the clean water money started the Aquatic Invasive Species Institute. Not a lot. And I am not on the Heritage Committee. They did not want to pay anything for the Institute, Aquatic Invasive, and so no money from there went for that. There has been some money that has gone from carp barriers, but as far as I know, I've given you all the money that I know about.
Okay. I'm glad for that answer. The reason I asked the question, I just wanted to be reminded of the fact that, in to a degree, at least the general taxpayers of the state are participating in this as well. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Representative Hansen, my question is something different than on the money end of it. I can't understand why this wouldn't be on the three-year cycle. I believe it's a three-year cycle that the regular boat license goes. And my editorial comment on that is that it's kind of a nuisance for the boat owner to do this annually. It creates another chore to do it. And I would hope that you'd consider changing it or amending the bill so it could be done on a three-year basis.
Mr. Chair and members, and I do want to note that we do have two citizens that have come forward from apparently a distance, so I would like to get them on, even if we're going to lay it over, to give them the opportunity. Relating to the period of the decal or the finances of the decal, I view that this bill is going to, if it goes to rules and then to environmental finance, we're going to have this conversation about what the amount should be and what the time period should be. I am not wedded to specific amounts or time periods in here. I would say, though, that on the decals, that we've seen changes, new lakes infested every year with zebra mussels. So with an annual decal, you have a point of contact with the owner, the boat owner, to inform them. You've got some chance there. Now, is there a cost to that, or how much should that cost be? There is a point of contact to have some information and education going on. Is this the best way? I think this is a way where we can make those contacts. And so I would commit to this committee and other committees is to have some I'm not wedded to this as exactly this is the way it should be. I'm willing to listen and see if there's some things that we can do to change here. But aquatic invasive species, we are investing general fund dollars. To go back to kind of our earlier conversations, we have a huge tourism industry, and we need to make sure that we're protecting that those fishing opportunities, those angling opportunities, and that tourism. And we've got, it's not just carp. It's not just zebra mussels. It's a variety of things, and we have to involve those folks that are in the boating community or in the angling community involved in that. So, I'm opening my hands here to say, you know, let's work on this. I know there are a number of questions. I would just ask the chair if we could maybe get the citizens to testify before the clock is out.
We will do that, Representative Hansen. And you know, like I remember 10 years ago, fishing on Namekin Lake in the Voyageurs National Park, and reeling my line up and watching this thing that looked like a piece of fur going down my line towards the water.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea what it was. I caught the walleye. That's what I was interested in. I later learned about the fact that it's fine water fleet. Representative Buechler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I like this bill because it provides an opportunity for us to reach more people on invasive species, and also it provides a great opportunity for us to educate out-of-state boaters, which are coming up all the time in the summer and may not be familiar with some of our invasive species laws. The one thing that I do have a little question on is the amount, $30 for a motorized out-of-state boat sticker. I think that's a little steep for the guy that's hauling a 16-foot Lund up with his 15-horse Johnson on the back. You know, possibly 20 would be something that we could look at in terms of cost. I mean, that gets to be a lot that way. But I really do like the idea of the outreach that this bill provides.
Thank you. And again, you know, our jurisdiction on the bill is basically the concept of the concept of the bill. And that would be something when it reaches the next destination, which I assume, and it will be my recommendation that after rules it would go to Representative Wagenius, that kind of information for those who serve on that committee would be worked out, those kind of details. Mr. Ness. Oh, sorry. Introduce yourself for the record and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony on the House file.
Chairman Dell, members of the committee, Barb Halbach in Fishburg. I'm on the executive board of Minnesota Coalition of Lake Associations, and I'm from Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. I'm here to testify in favor of this bill. I think it's a very good bill. Some of the things that we encounter in Detroit Lakes, being a border state, is that a large percentage of our watercraft come from North Dakota. And one of the reasons that our organization likes to supports this bill is that it gives an opportunity for people that are coming from out of state to become familiar with any changes that may have occurred the previous year and what they may need to comply with to protect our state water resources. And this bill also offers us continued stabilized long-term dedicated funding, which is very important to many of the areas that depend on our water for recreational purposes in our tourism industry. And locally, we have spent over $612,000 in the last 3 years with local funding to support invasive species. And so we look at this as being a mechanism to be able to help fund some of those expenses. And we look forward to working with the agency as we've continued to do to support and make changes that will make this a better bill for all of us in protecting our water resources.
Well, thank you. Could you spell your last name for the record, please?
Yes, H-A-L-B-A-K-K-E-N. Capital F-I-S-C-H-B-U-R-G, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much, and welcome. Questions for the testifier? Being none, Mr. Ness.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lance Ness. I'm president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance and Anglers for Habitat. We support the bill in its conception. We need to act on invasive species, and this is we got to start moving towards it, so this is a good start. My members do have a lot of questions, and so I told Representative I'd like to bring those questions to you as we work through this bill. And I'll just read the questions off, and then you can certainly ask me more. First question is, who gets the funding, and what will it be used for? Second question is, who will do the enforcement and of the sticker itself? Who will be doing this enforcement? Is it going to be DNR? Is it going to be sheriffs, county deputies, things like that? What about out-of-state boaters and users? How are they going to be handled? As Barb said, a lot of folks come from North Dakota into the Detroit Lakes area. Same thing, Wisconsin boaters come back and forth. Iowa boaters come up. How is that going to be handled? We'd also like to see some mandatory border safety education. Happens in other states, but how often? Every 3 years? I know that was raised up. I think that's a good point. Or every year? And how many boats? If I, for instance, have three boats, do I have to take a test for every boat? Do I have to pass a course for every boat I own, including a canoe? So I have questions about that. And then finally, we'd just like to encourage Representative Hansen and others to work with also the new AIS Advisory Committee and other stakeholders as we move forward on this issue, because this is a very important issue. It deals with lots of aquatic invasive species and not just carp, which is a poster child, as we call it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Mr. Ness? Being none, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and give your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Schneider. I'm a Chanhassen resident, and I am a board member of the Minnesota COLA Cooperative, as is Barb. I'm here in support of House File 1442 as a new revenue source must be found to help stop the spread of AIS, and that every user of Minnesota waters needs to play a part in sharing that cost. But I do ask you to consider amending it to designate the majority of this funding, the majority of this revenue, for grants to the local government units for their efforts in stopping the spread of aquatic invasive species. Just a few weeks ago, DNR Director Hirsch testified in front of Representative Wagenius's Environment Finance Committee, and he described a good complementary arrangement between the DNR and the local government units for stopping the spread of aquatic invasive species. Director Hirsch talked about two components of that cooperative arrangement, with the DNR focusing their AIS inspection on high-use zebra mussel-infested waters, and the local governments using or interested in their AIS inspections for inbound traffic to their local waters. As someone who has testified a lot in front of Carver County government and other cities in our area, I can tell you the local government units do not have any money for this. And to think that there's a good complementary arrangement that is just going to happen somehow is not really going to happen. So they are not positioned for success. And among other things, that one of the things they don't have in their positioning is they don't have any funding for this. So please consider designating a majority of this new revenue stream for grants to the local government units so they can do their part in this good complementary arrangement.
Questions of the testifier? Being none, thank you. Well, one of the answers is I received it from Representative Cornish, is that I see law says hire three more wardens for ore to stop the invasive species. I don't know if that'll be popular in the ore area, but nonetheless, Representative Cornish is always working on behalf of the conservation officers. Any other people to testify for or against? Representative Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith, could you come down? Welcome. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement.
Thank you. Obviously, in this bill is going to be a component of enforcement. As you just generally read the bill now, how do you see the role of enforcement playing out in this bill? As it's drafted today, obviously, there will likely be some changes along the way. But, I mean, I sense that DNR Enforcement will play a lead role in this.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We would play a lead role in this, and to answer one of the questions of who would enforce this, I guess we would have to look at how the penalty provisions are placed in this. If this is strictly criminal, then licensed peace officers and conservation officers can deal with this under 84D. I guess under 86, as I look at this, this is actually in Chapter 86, so this would be a criminal misdemeanor as it lies in Chapter 86B, so there wouldn't be any civil penalty portion to it unless we'd have to. Okay, all right. But there would be a considerable enforcement component to this, as with all new laws that come about, and so as a division, we'd have to educate our folks, you know, talking with some of our people and talking with the stakeholder groups. You know, some of the concerns we had is this means this is all boats right now, and as we all probably know, it's easy to pass a law, but what gets really hinky is the exceptions to the law. I mean, are we going to accept barges?
You know, what about Coast Guard registered watercraft on rivers? You know, you own a resort and you have 15 rental boats. Does the resort owner have to take this test 15 times and put a sticker on every rental boat that they have? So that's where some of these details need to be worked out with the author and the stakeholder group so that it's something usable for folks. You know, as far as the licensing portion goes with the non-residents, I mean, this is great. It hits all people. You know, if you're a non-resident and you drive all night and get to Lake Capitogama and you want to go fishing the next day and you forgot to do this training, is it available to do online or something at the resort so you don't have to drive into I Falls to get a sticker or something like that? So there's some of those details that need to be worked out with the bill and the author. I know the author and the stakeholder group are willing to work as we move forward.
Questions for Colonel Smith? Good to hear from you down there at the end of the table, Representative. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, how is this going to affect some of our border waters with North Dakota and the Red and down here in Wisconsin? And
thank you, Representative Green.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, that's a good question, too. That was one of the things we've been talking about up there is, you know, how we're going to handle this on our border waters. And it's going to be challenging, depending on which border you're on, because we do have some agreements with Wisconsin on how we enforce some laws, but that is a little different with North Dakota as with Iowa, so we'd have to look at those individually and work with the author and the stakeholders on how to address those issues. So it's pretty much a non-answer, but I really don't know at this point.
Colonel Smith, what do you do with you know, my whole district is Canada. The border is all Canada for hundreds and hundreds of miles, so... And the land of 10,000 lakes is right there. So how do you deal with that with foreign boats? Would they be treated, in your mind, in this bill, same as a boat from out of state? So a boat coming on Rainy Lake from Bears Pass over to Island View for dinner for the evening, he'd have to have an invasive permit on the boat?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. I mean, as is written today, yes.
Representative Green.
Well, I guess I do have some concerns, and that is one of them. The other is the training. I mean, there's a lot of things that we don't even know, and we're putting this through. We just passed some invasive species last year, I believe, and hasn't really had a chance to work. Are we rushing into something here?
Representative Hansen. To Representative Green's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Green, we've been dealing with invasive species, struggling with invasive species, aquatic invasive species and terrestrial invasive species for a number of years. And I think when we're hearing from some of the folks that are seeing this happen in their communities, they're looking for additional help. And so, yes, we've taken action. I think we're going to probably take some action every year for a while here. As I've said before, I think it's very important to hear these concerns and to get on the table into the open arena here, the issues involved, because this is a big change. And it needs to be well vetted and to make sure that we have the best product moving forward. And that's why I'm open.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Representative Hansen. The way I'm reading this, you know, I'm concerned about this training talk. I'm looking at Subdivision 2 when you talk educational materials in the bill. I'm looking at the fact that the educational information is distributed, but there is no test or written test or online test or whatever. Am I correct in that, or... is there actually a training course you have to go through?
I think if you look at, and you're on Subdivision 2, 2.16
yes.
through 2.23, and it says the commissioner shall develop AIS educational information to be provided to applicants with annual aquatic decal. The educational information must include a list of applicable laws, information to help identify, and a link to waters that have been listed. The commissioner shall ensure that all applicants for a decal under this section acknowledge receipt of the educational information. purchase of the decal and receipt of educational information constitute express acknowledgement. So that's back to my days of doing certification and training. There's a difference between information, education, and training. The way I read this is information and education.
That's the way I'm reading it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Erdman may disagree.
Representative Hansen?
I thought Mr. Erdman was raising his hand, but that's the way I interpret it.
No, Mr. Chairman, I think there was a little bit of confusion. We have had discussions with the agency concerning various online programming. It's very similar to what's going on with the Lake Service Provider training, but that is not reflected in the current language before you. This is merely an educational tool at this point. You are correct, sir.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make a comment. I think the decal itself will get the state of Minnesota talking about this issue, both it being new and it's right on there. It'll be the buzz of the community for a while, and I think it'll jumpstart it.
You know, I suspect the emails will start lighting up around here as well. But, I mean, it is Representative Wagenius, I agree on this one that what do you say about the prevention versus the cure? It's cheaper on the front end. Anyone in the audience to testify for or against the bill as amended? There being none. This bill, we're 15 minutes past due. This bill is like a long way from being ready to go. I absolutely appreciate, Representative Hansen, that you are bringing this forward because, I know that you have a great passion for this. I think that what we're going to do is we're going to amend the Hansen motion to lay the bill over, keep it in this committee, and that we will hear it again, or at least schedule to hear it again, on the same day that we hear Representative Fisher's water conservation bill. And then at that time, if we can work out some of the details, answer the questions that Mr. Ness had, answer a couple of questions that Representative Uglem had about the training, Lieutenant Colonel Smith about enforcement and some of those things and criminal penalties or those kinds of things, we'll have a better chance to do it. Representative Hansen.
Can I go first on that, Dave?
Going on.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Hansen reduces the motion and we'll lay the bill over. Thank you. Meeting adjourned. Yeah.